Yes, it's that time of year again. Of course, we love WKRP all year long, but especially now as we get closer to Thanksgiving and recall that incredibly funny episode. Did you know we have 5 different WKRP designs, including 3 different turkey drop-inspired ones? Simply go to cincyshirts.com and type WKRP into the search bar and have a look. Use the promo code at the end of this episode to save 20% on your entire order, online or in-store. Now, on with the show.
WKRP in Cincinnati.
This is WCPO-FM, 1051 on your FM dial, Cincinnati, Ohio.
WKRC, Cincinnati. With
this is the Nation Station.
Hi again, everyone, and welcome to the Cincy Shirts Podcast. It's episode 94. Today on our show, Doc Wolf.
They decide they're going to put the heat on us. And so they start calling around and saying, we're investigating this Gilbert Gnarly you have working there that's been calling the White House. We have an indicator that he's called the White House 5 times in the past 3 years, and they give us dates and everything.
You remember Doc Wolf from the Gary Burbank Show, where he was co-host, sidekick, etc., for the show's entire run, save for a year off when he wrote a fat-free cookbook. We hear about that effort, as well as behind-the-scenes stories about Gilbert Gnarly, Earl Pitts, and how the latter saved Jerry Springer's life once. We hear about Bob Trumpy, Bat Wrangler, and there's tea on some famous folks who stopped by the Burbank Show, and a whole lot more. You really want to stick around for this one. So if you've been liking the podcast, you can support it via PayPal or Venmo. Simply use podcast at cincyshirts.com. Kick in whatever you feel is fair. And also be sure to listen for the special promo code for 20% off near the end of the episode. Now let's talk to Doc Wolf.
Cincinnati, Ohio. Cincinnati, Ohio.
I come from
C-I-N-C-I-N-N-A-T-I, Cincinnati.
She came down from Cincinnati. Just maybe think of me once in a while. I'm at
CincyShirts.com in Cincinnati.
Welcome to our sophisticated space.
Thank you. I expected egg cartons, you know, like on Keyhole, but these are much nicer.
Yeah. Amazon. Pretty exciting.
Pretty amazing what you can get on Amazon. Or Alibaba if you want to risk it.
Yeah.
We've gone down that.
No. That's crap.
This is 4 cents on Alibaba, and it's $30 on Amazon. How does that work?
My wife's friend buys all kinds of stuff off Alibaba. She swears by it.
You gotta go to the source, man.
When I
worked at a computer company, we bought shirts, like sweatshirts from China, and they literally shipped them from the factory. And the person we were dealing with's English was about that big, and we were just, it was like communicating was just, I don't know, paid some ridiculous price, like $3 for a printed shirt, printed sweatshirt, and got there, and they were, you know, they were reasonable quality, but somebody, one of the guys is passing them out to clients, and he reaches in the pocket of his shirt, a sweatshirt that he just put on, and he pulls out this really bizarre looking scissors contraption, and it looks like tweezers, but it's got 2 blades on the end of it, so it's got 2 pointed blades just sticking out, you know.
Wow.
And he was like, "Oh man, I'm really glad we didn't give it to a client." So they stuck their hand in there and ripped it open.
Razor blades in your Halloween candy,
right?
Right.
Check your sweatshirts, kids. Bet mom and dad look at those sweatshirts.
Yeah,
that's hilarious. Yeah, you never know what you're gonna get. That's for sure.
So
thanks for coming.
It's about time. That's all I can say is it's about time I came in.
So where did you get your doctorate?
I don't even have an honorary doctorate, but it was Gary was looking for a nickname for me, and he thought that Mr. was kind of lame and didn't want to use the professor because Jim LaBarber was a music professor.
Oh, there you go.
So he said, we got to think of something. And I said, well, my dad used to call me doctor when I was a kid. He goes, that's it. That's it. You're Dr. Wolf. And I said, you could have called everybody doctor. And he's like, no, that's it. We'll go with that.
You did better than senior buddy Whiplash.
Yeah, right.
Be thankful for that.
Yes, or special ed.
What was Rob's other name? He had two. Senior buddy Whiplash, and then he was...
I don't know.
JD was Slim Tempo, right?
Yeah, and Damien was Buzz Fechtel in his dancing parakeets.
Okay.
So
nice.
It was just an endless.
Where do these nicknames come from? Like, is it just
in the mind of Gary?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, they like literally just pop out. You know? They just they all of a sudden it's like, okay, we got part of the weird thing about that show was that there was no time to think of anything. That, like, literally from 6 o'clock in the morning, we got up and started writing. And then, like, at 10:30, we were at work. And I'd go grab lunch and bring it in, and we'd do a working lunch while we're editing scripts. And we had 6 or 7 other people who wrote, who would contribute. And Gary'd sit there and edit. And we'd go through all that. One day, when I was talking to him, I said, it was like 2:05, and we had just done our first break, and I said, do you realize it's the first time we've laughed all day? And he's like, oh, you're right. Because I said, we sit there and we're going over scripts going, that's not funny. That's not, my God, that's hilarious. God, that's not funny. And it's just crossing them up, and nobody's laughing because we're all so intent on working.
The latter were probably mine.
Yeah. I'm sure.
Yeah. That's how it is, right? You kind of get numb to what's, I mean, you know what's funny, but right. As far as what makes you laugh.
Right, right.
It really, really changes over time.
And Gary always said that getting on the air was really our playtime, because he said we had already put in an 8-hour day by the time we got on the air, and then we were able to play around and think a little more than we were, because you know it was just like editing. It's like, oh, we got to fix this script, what do we got to do, and you know, go in and have to make changes and modify. Or he'd take a script sometimes and it would be like, okay, there's one brilliant idea in this horrible piece of garbage, and we'd have to figure out how to make that a bit. So
nice. So is he more of a tyrant, or did everyone feel like their ideas were, you know, you're open and not afraid to pitch anything? And
nobody saw that but me and him. So just because we were the only two in the studio, and eventually Leah Burns was part of that, and then Duke and Rob got into the mix. And so as that went over time, we started to run into, you know, more and more input into stuff. But Gary had a really good sense of what was funny and what wasn't, you know. His attitude was always, you know, somebody would tell him the script was hilarious, and he'd go, it may be hilarious, but it's not funny. So we're not doing it, you know. And so, and that kept the quality low.
Yeah. We'll add that to the Burbank collection, I'm sure.
Nice. So what time period are we talking about here? Because, you know, for people who might not have been around for the show.
So I started with Gary in 81. Just before the Red Strike, and that was a huge plus for him to start radio, like right literally at the start of a big event. And when that happened, and the advantage was that Gary didn't know anything about Cincinnati. You know, he didn't know the neighborhoods. He didn't know who you're supposed to poke fun at and who you're not. So he just wound up working with doing stuff on the Reds, which he knew incredibly well. And that worked out really, really great for our first few months there. We had the Reds fan can pledge drive and try to get canned goods for the players during the strike. And, you know, it took off incredibly well. It takes Gary about 6 months in a market to be noticed. And so in Cincinnati, that happened a lot quicker, like Louisville, and he was in Florida for a while. I think he was in Florida for like 6 months, so it's like they never caught on.
and CKLW in Detroit.
Yeah. And so he would always be in a position where it was like all of a sudden one day everybody would realize he was there. And then he, you know, he was gold, and then he was usually number one in his time slot. So
when I first started doing stand-up on the road, I went to the comedy club in Tampa.
Yeah.
And they had a case in the lobby of like merchandise from different comedians who've played there.
Yeah.
and then they had Gary Burbank's cassette tapes. Right. And I was just like, I couldn't wrap my head around how these Gary Burbank tapes ended up
in Tampa.
In a case in the comedy club in Tampa.
Well, there's two things fed into that. Number one, Tampa was where he was in Florida for his whole 6 months. And he had... the biggest problem about Florida is that audience pays no attention to radio. You know, if it didn't involve your health or finances, you know, and you were under 60, you know, it's like everybody down there is just so interested in those few topics, and they really don't care what's going on the radio. So that was kind of a struggle for him to get on there and to kind of grow that audience. But then Earl Pitts took off hugely there, and so he wound up with like Earl Pitts. Earl Pitts saved his neck a few times. Jerry Springer was one. He was in they used to go down to Dream Week with the Reds, where you go down and you pretend to be a ball player, and they were in some bar, and all of a sudden Springer is talking to this girl, and this biker who's playing pool stands up and shouts, "Hey, that guy over there with the glasses is messing with your girlfriend." And all of a sudden, it was like Jerry Springer surrounded by about four or five bikers. And Gary just walks up and he goes, "Hey, do you all know Earl Pitts?" And all of a sudden, two of the guys go, "Yeah, yeah." And he goes, "I'm Earl Pitts." And all of a sudden, they forgot Jerry Springer. Springer quietly walked away.
Wow. Checkbook back in his pocket.
Yep.
So let's start with you, your roots. Yeah. Are you local guy?
I've lived here since I was 6 months old. So
6 months.
Yeah. So I was born in Louisville. And then, so I can claim dual citizenship when I'm Kentucky. I say, hey, I was born here.
We're not raising a kid here. We've got a free... Yeah.
No, my dad got a. My dad was worked for the unions, and so he got a really nice job here with the brewery workers. Their local was here, and so we moved to Cincinnati for that. And then I've lived here ever since. Haven't left town. You know, I lived in Anderson Township. That is leaving town, kind of. But
right. So, what high school?
I went to Woodward.
All right.
And Schroeder Junior High, and still live in Kennedy Heights, the same place I grew up.
Uh-huh. No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, I just bought a place about a half mile from where my mom and my sister live, and so I'm back in the community permanently. I was going to spend my retirement in Yellow Springs, and then it's like this popped up, and it's
you
like,
and Dave Chappelle.
Yeah,
yeah, it's right on the corner.
Yeah, Chappelle's a surprisingly accessible person when he's in Yellow Springs. Just, you know, he walks into Dino's coffee shop every morning, gets a coffee, and you can just talk to him, and it's fascinating just to sometimes. Noah Adams also, who was with NPR, his wife runs the local NPR station up there. Wow. When he retired, he moved up there.
Wow.
And he still does stuff for NPR. And the first time I met him, I thought he was homeless and I was going to give him a buck.
That's great. Yeah, it's a good spot to just unwind, yeah, let it all out.
It is. And financially, it just turned out that I found in our community in Kennedy Heights, we have a housing co-op. And it just like unbelievable low price to buy a place and get in. And it's really, really a cool thing. It's been around since the 60s, and I just happened to luck into it.
Nice.
So where'd you go to college?
I went to Xavier, and I can say Xavier because I went there.
There you go.
It's a big debate. We actually made a T-shirt.
Yeah.
It's pronounced Xavier.
Well, you'll get everybody from the school to tell you otherwise, but I always pronounced it Xavier when I was there, and just to irritate people, I guess. But yeah, I got a communications degree from Xavier, and worked at the campus radio station there for 4 years, and was music director and that was actually fun. The college part wasn't so fun, but hanging out at the radio station was the reason to stick around.
Yeah.
So
So you've had an obsession with radio then most of your life then, huh? Or you just kind of got in where you fit in, or how
it started? Where were you there? It started when I was 16, and my cousin was a newsman at WSAI. And I asked him when I was 15, do they have any jobs there? And he's like, well, you couldn't start till you're 16, but you could probably answer telephones or something. And so which was, you know, for me being 16, it was like that was much more appealing than burning my hands on cooking fries.
Yeah.
So I got the gig there. Working there, I was just really fortunate. They weren't going to hire me because of my age in school. And the guy who they had, who was running the request line, the honcho of the request line, just said, I'm going back to the Army. I'm making more money in the Army than I'm making here. So he left, and I came in, and I started working 48 hours a week. And I worked full-time through high school and through college, and was there for about 8.5 years. And worked my way from telephone operator up to having a weekend air shift, and then finally on to SAI FM when they went rock. So it was fun. It was wonderful, good experience to have to really kind of go through all the people I went through there, because you know you're amazed at times that you work with somebody and then 10 years later, somebody says, oh, they're a legend. Oh my God. And you're like, really? It's like, yeah. I used to get his coffee for him.
So were you a big music person too, or more of a radio person?
More radio than anything. I mean, I was a big fan of skit comedy, radio skit comedy and stuff on albums. I thought that was great. And that's where the kind of where the Burbank angle fit in there,
like the credibility gap and all that.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And then and Congress of Wonders was another one that was an off the wall group. And I would just kind of go in there and hang out. We had a news guy, Jim Cavanaugh, who did the overnight shift and was so bored, he created a fake farm cast. And the farm news, actually all radio stations ran the farm news at that time, because that was where the big money was, that the seed companies and the fertilizer companies would pay 5 times normal rates of prime time just to buy a specific spot, like 5:10 a.m. or something. And Cavanaugh did a whole fake farm report around real farm news, you know, which was the sow belly prices from the day before. And it was just hilarious, and so I got to participate in that. That was a lot of fun.
Is that where they looked at the hog reports on KRP? That you reckon that's where that came from? I know it's based on a station in Atlanta, but...
Well, LW, when I started with WLW, we were told... Actually, this was a few years later. Randy Michaels, at a staff meeting, he said that more than half of your salary is paid by the farm report advertising, which was for an hour in the morning, and Ed Bousman, the radio preacher who bought an hour worth of time every week, and he said, that's what we're making all our money off of. We got to change this. This is not how to do it.
Wow.
So it was a big thing. They were paying, like at 5 a.m, these agriculture companies were paying $500 for a 30-second spot, and anybody could have bought that spot, like half an hour before for $40. And it's just, they wanted it at a specific time where the farmers were up and the farmers were out doing milking in the morning or whatever. And that was what was really important to them. So, you know, you had Monsanto and some of these other big companies all buying that space.
Jeez.
With some recollection of that when I first moved here, hearing those on LW.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they did them for years.
Yeah.
Probably they ran the farm reports until probably about 89. I went through about 3 or 4 farm directors while I was there. And
they still did, like, into the 90s when I moved here, they were still doing ads, I think, or something.
They probably
like
did, and they probably had the news guys reading the
Sal Belly
prices, you know. But one of the farm directors was telling me he went to some kind of a farm convention, and he said there were all these guys in suits walking around, and he was like, he was really curious, like everybody's in overalls, but these few guys, and he went up, and their investment guys and bankers, and he said that they listen to the stock report every morning to track the agriculture prices because that's what they did. They're investing in, and so they came out and hung out with the farmers to get the skinny on what's going on. So
you go from SAI to WLW.
I went from SAI went after the rock days that we had a nice little spell of rock days, which lasted about a year and a half. And at that time, they hired all of the people that EBN had fired who were great. So we had Jeff Nimmo and Jake Gilbert and Dave Howe. And Dave Howe was the morning guy on EBN, the first morning guy. And he worked there for a while. So we had great collection of people. And then you had people coming up, me, Eddie Fingers, Mary Kuzan, were all part of that. So it was a really wonderful time, and we beat EBN for one book. That was our big claim to fame.
Yeah, we just had Eddie on.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like Randy Michael's name comes up more on this podcast than anybody else's.
Yeah, I think so. Jeff Ruby be second.
Yeah. Randy's an interesting character because he's very hated. By rights, I should hate him because the fact that, you know, he really destroyed radio, that, you know, we went from the era where people were making a reasonable living to now the point that, you know, people in radio, again, their salaries cut all the time and, you know, you can barely function on it. And it's not necessarily because of anything wrong with radio. It's just that podcasting is taken over. You know, it's like, you know, the number of people listening to podcasts are just amazing, and that audience is all that radio audience is being picked up by people who can, like, tune into you guys whenever they want to. You know, it's like they got a half hour in the car ride in the morning, and it's like, hey, I'm going to listen to the Shirts podcast.
Yeah.
So
no commercials. Yeah.
But and we've talked about it on here before with radio people, is that I feel like very few stations realized in time anyway that the one commodity they have is to talk to people about stuff that matter to that person, that songs can be played by that person in a myriad of ways whenever they want. They don't have to sit around and wait for that song that they want to hear to come back on again.
Right. We had Walkmans long before we had, you know, iPods. And so everybody was able to tune in, and they were in your car. You had it. Think back to the time you had 8-track players. You know, everybody had access to, you know, immediate access to the music they wanted in their car. That made a, you know, that was a huge thing. But there's also, there were some other factors that went into that, were just things like small town radio stations are still doing well. And the reason is because they provide a service that nobody else provides. And, you know, a big city radio station's got to be, you know, cover a big area, and small town can, like, the guy.
But they could provide it. It's just corporate, you know, they just choose not to.
Well, a lot of times it's, you know, it's syndicated. Now it's syndicated stuff. Yeah. But, like, a guy I know has a radio station in North or South Carolina, he and his brother, and the most popular show is Tradio on Sunday. Where they literally just gets on the air and people call in, and it's like, hey, I got a,
you know,
I got a bass boat that's 23 years old, and
so good,
you know, and it's like, I'm selling for $200, and, you know, somebody will call back in and go, what color is it?
And Howard Stern's always screwing with those people.
Well, and what really is funny is that they wound up they discovered quite by accident that there was a parking lot in town, a vacant lot, and these people were meeting there on Sunday listening to the show, trading stuff, and so they set up a remote there every Sunday, and it was just like this thing where it was the big event of the week, where people are driving in and out, they're coming to look to see what people have, and it kind of became its own flea market. So those kind of places, you know, as small time as that is, that's really serving people, and that's what people want live radio for.
Yeah.
Well, really, a big chunk of the Burbank show, one of the most popular bits, All My Bengals.
Yeah.
You can't do that anywhere else.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And you know, we first started with Randy because we'd been at LW. And we just so it's clear, when Gary and I started at LW, we were the most outrageous thing on the air. And by the time Gary retired, it was the least outrageous show on the air. But when Randy came in, he had this heart-to-heart talk with us about playing records, because at the time we were playing records. And he said, well, just ask yourself, if what you're doing is better than a Beatles record, then do it. And Gary walked out of the meeting and goes, all our bits are better than Beatles records. We're not going to play any more records again. We never did. We didn't play another record after that.
So how did you get teamed up with Gary? Because his last stop was Louisville, right?
He was. I used to listen to him on HAS. As a matter of fact, it was kind of like he was my hero. and I went and I got a frickin' AM/FM stereo that I had to cut out my dash to fit in there. That was so powerful it could pick up HAS from Louisville, clearly. So,
that's hilarious.
So I'd drive around in the afternoons listening to Gary.
Did you have that big giant antenna on your car that was like
the big ham radio?
I didn't. It was the standard stick, but I was able to pick up HAS clearly. So I was well versed in him, and I had been sending him stuff over the years, I'd see a funny news clipping or something, just kind of randomly send it to him. Never heard a word from him at all, just would send it and thought, well, maybe he got it, maybe he didn't. And all of a sudden I get a phone call and he's like, hey, I'm coming to town and I need a producer and they're putting me with some people who don't get humor at all. And he said, I told him I need my own producer that I pick. And he says, are you interested? And it's like, yeah. And I wasn't working at the time.
Never met him before or anything?
Never met him before.
Sending him stuff.
Just from sending stuff. And I met him and we had a talk. And he said, I really need somebody who knows the city, who knows who do I jab, what are the deals, what are the neighborhoods in town, all those important things for a host, because literally, if you walk into a city and you don't know any of that stuff and you try to do humor, you're going to fall flat on your face, because you're going to pick the stuff that's wrong, that people just like, you don't get the vibe here.
Yeah.
So you started in the afternoon, right?
We started in the morning.
Oh, morning. I'm sorry.
Yeah, for like a year and a half, we were on in the morning, and then moved to the afternoons, and that was morning show was. Morning show was fine. It still haunts me because it's like I can't sleep past 4 a.m. Just never got away from that from that year and a half of doing it so much. But we used to do mornings and then migrated to afternoons. Still, when we were downtown, on 4th Street for 3 or 4 or 5 years before we moved up to Mount Adams. So it was a real horrible building, still there, and we used to have bats in the building. And what would happen is the bats would get up on the roof, and they would nest there. And when it got cold, they would literally fall in through the vents, and you'd have bats flying down the hall. And Bob Trumpy was the best guy at catching bats. And these hallways were narrow, and they were like circular. It was like a four-cornered hallway. It just went around, and I remember one day Trumpy just like, somebody's like, oh my God, there's a bat in the hallway. And this bat is flying around in circles. And Trumpy just walks out with the garbage can and just throws it, and it just nails this bat. Knocks him out, the garbage can lands on the ground, he just puts the garbage can over, he goes, call maintenance.
Nice. Call Thane Maynard.
Right. So speaking of Trumpy, how do Sports or Consequences get started?
I'm not really sure. It's just kind of, I think it just materialized one day. I think we asked a sports question and had Trumpy come in to answer it, and it just became a thing. And then it just went beyond being anything about sports. It was just, we'd shovel all of our guests into there because, they would send somebody around and say, hey, they're going to be doing a book tour. So we just bring them in and make them part of the show as opposed to doing an interview with them. But the funniest one of all time was we had accidentally double booked Roy Rogers and the Playmate of the Year on the same day. And so she gets in and she's like 21, And she has no idea who Roy Rogers is at all. And she's just like, doesn't get that all of these, she's there dressed in her skimpy little outfit, and all of these guys are drooling at Roy Rogers. And she's like, she didn't know what it was. And by the end of the conversation, she could have been sitting in his lap listening to stories because he was just so unbelievably enthralling with everything. And the coolest thing about him was he was so genuine. Everything that came out of his mouth, he meant. There was nothing in there that was a planned talk. And
did he come on the show much?
Only there one time. He was touring for something, and he came in, he was like 80, comes in his cowboy outfit with the hat and everything. And so we start talking with him, and said, somebody said that you had Trigger, your horse, stuffed. And he goes, oh yeah, Trigger's in my living room. And then somebody says, well, somebody said you had your dog Bullet stuffed. Yeah, yeah, Bullet's right next to Trigger. And he pulls me aside in a break, and he says, I hope you don't mind. He says, I cheat on Dale sometimes. And I don't want the guys who brought me in, my handlers, to know. And I go, oh, and I thought he was going to ask me to get the Playmate's phone number. he says, can you get me a Diet Coke? when you know Roy Rogers, you just like, man, it's like, here's this guy who like literally drinks milk, you know?
And, yeah.
And
here he is saying that he wants a Diet Coke. And it was fun. It was quite an engaging conversation. And it was a spectacle to watch so many people just, I've never seen anybody, you know, just act so enthralled over anybody before, you know. But everybody in that room knew who he was.
He's got a drink named after him.
Yeah.
And a fast food restaurant.
And a fast food restaurant.
That's right, right. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Well, who knew we'd get tea on Roy Rogers?
So is that probably the biggest, celebrity moment for you? Or I mean, did he interview, like, tough presidents and stuff, right? Or
no.
Gary
was
did.
That
Jim Scott.
Was Jim
did.
Scott.
We
okay.
We got caught by the White House, by the Secret Service a few times. WLW had booked Fountain Square for a rally, for Happy Cincinnati Day rally or something, and got a call from the Secret Service saying that George Bush Sr. wanted it for an event. They wanted to do some filming of a commercial for his reelection campaign. Dave Reinhardt, the PD, said... He said, well, you can't have it. It's like, we booked this month in advance. We got all this other stuff. And so they decide they're going to put the heat on us. And so they start calling around and saying, we're investigating this Gilbert Gnarly you have working there that's been calling the White House. We haven't indicated that he's called the White House five times in the past 3 years. And they gave us dates and everything when he had called. And Gary knew that one of the guys from the Secret Service in town was pretty good friends with him. And a guy from Washington calls up and he goes, we need you to investigate Gilbert Gnarly, who works for WLW Radio. And Murph is on the phone and he just starts laughing. And he's got this smoker's hack that just is like, you just hear him rolling back. And he goes, that's just Burbank. And they're like, who? And this is somebody else we have to investigate. He goes, I'm not investigating him. So Gary remained clear. We also had Michael Jackson's mother on. That was pretty cool because she didn't know what to expect. And at the end of the show, she was she was chanting with everybody else, you know.
Nice. She came in the studio.
She had a book out. And so, you know, they thought there was going to be a big interview. And she just seemed like the type of person who really didn't want an interview at all anyway. And so when we started saying, hey, this is a sports show we're putting you on. I know it's going to sound kind of weird, but we're going to feed you some answers and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. And she just got into it. She thought it was a great thing. We had a lot of other people in and out over the years that he had that came in. But I think one of the beauties of that was just that it was a live show that would never have flown if it had just been a over the phone interview.
I remember every year, this reminds me, that Duke would, and yeah, you must have been in on it too, would try to fool Gary with a guest.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the only one I remember is the guy who was going to start the golf league for people that were 5 foot four and under.
Yes.
And Gary bought it for, like, the whole segment.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And every year it seems you got him.
Yeah, yeah. That was usually Duke and Rob that did that. You know, I steered clear just because I didn't want to. I didn't want to cause any animosity, you know.
So I did some Facebook stalking on you.
Uh-oh.
And there's so much to dive into on here, but I want to go back to something that I had pulled up when you were talking about your dad.
Yeah.
So there was a cool throwback Thursday post you had about Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah, yeah.
And how he was pen pals with your dad.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Can you...
Like,
talk more about your dad and how did he get into the union stuff? Because that's a new area that we've kind of...
You haven't hit on? Yeah, and my dad was looking back on my dad when I hit my 20s, it was suddenly like he was a very different person than I knew. My dad was not at home a lot, and he was on committees. He was on all this stuff. He was out almost every night at some meeting, you know, working on being the, you know, being fighting the good fight. When he retired, there was a
what did he do?
He was the education and research director. And essentially with unions, at least at that time, a majority of the people had never finished high school. He was the only guy with a college education there. And so he wound up doing everything. Like, there's the guy who wrote the newsletter. His whole job was to write the newsletter, and he couldn't pull it together. So my dad's like, oh, I'll do that. And so he did all kinds of work. He did all kinds of seminars where he'd go around and talk to union groups, and they would organize, you know, they'd organize an event in a town, and he'd come and speak about something. So he had a history of doing that. He originally started with the mail carriers in Louisville, and I think that And I haven't investigated this, but I think that he was the organizer for the mail carriers union in Kentucky, because that's a right to work state. And so unions really don't have the same pull they had in other places. And once he retired, he started his own foundation, and then he also became the nominating committee for the Eugene V. Debs Award, which is Indiana University's award that they give out. And originally it went to mostly labor people. And then when he got in, he's like, we should be giving this to people who talk about labor, because they're the ones who are actually keeping the labor in the news. And so he gave the award to Ed Asner when he did a thing on a TV movie on unions, and John Sayles, he had done some stuff with some of his movies, and he was gonna give it to Michael Moore just before he died, and he sent it to Vonnegut because Vonnegut had kind of this labor history in the book Jailbird, and so he said, hey, you've won the Eugene V. Debs Award. It's because my dad was everything. It was the nominating committee, the voting committee. He was, you know, it was just whatever he wanted to do. And so he just started picking people he wanted to meet. And so he talks to Vonnegut's like, I'd be honored. You know, I'm from Indiana, and I'd be honored to come. And so they come down, and my dad, who's, you know, at the time shrinking and probably, you know, 5'4". And Kurt Vonnegut, who's like, you know, 12 feet tall, hanging around together. And they became chums, and they just kept sending letters to each other. And my dad would write like these 6-page letters to Vonnegut, and Vonnegut would send back a 1-paragraph reply. So we still have all the Vonnegut letters. Yeah. And like one of the things that, like, you know, I always remember from the letters was they had just adopted their daughter. He and Jill had just adopted their daughter Lily. And they said, I've left instructions if anything happens to Jill or I that Lily will be raised by Jim Wolfe of Cincinnati.
Wow.
So, kiddingly, but at the same time,
is that surreal for you though? Like to like even now to talk about it as like you know,
if I had been a monstrous Vonnegut fan, that would have had more impact on me. But when I met him, it was just I was asking him just questions curious. Like he was a guy, you know, and because I was like questions out of my mouth was like you know you seem to smoke a lot. Is that how is it that you're how is it you're not you know, dead already. And he's like, you know, as a kid, I was a swimmer. And he said, I almost made the Olympic team and was, you know, a state champion swimmer. And he says, I just got big lungs and that helped out. So we had like a half an hour of a normal conversation, you know, which was great because he, I guess, you know, when you get to that level, you're so used to people talking to you from a totally different point of view.
Yeah.
That they're not really interested in what, they're kind of interested in hearing their voice, asking you the question. And they're really not interested. They probably already know the answer. Whereas, you know, he just really felt this was great.
Man, so, like I can't process
that. I know.
I only talked to Vonnegut once after that. And that was to let him know the dad had passed away. And I called him and said, so it was kind of like, hey, we got Kurt Vonnegut's phone number.
Yeah, and he answered, huh?
He answered. Yeah, when they were living, I guess, on Long Island, and he lived in some little town up north on Long Island, and it was just great having a chance to chat with him. So, but the strange thing was that of all the quotes my dad passed around, was actually from Vonnegut's son, Mark, who wrote a book called The Eden Express. And his quote was, when he was asked why we're here, he says, we're all here to help each other through this thing, whatever it is. And my dad would perpetually quote that to people when they would ask, why do you do something? Why do you go out of your way to help people like this? And he'd just throw that around.
And then some other stuff I saw on there. So you've done some cookbooks.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I'm working on another one right as we speak.
That's awesome. So I want to talk about the first one.
The fat-free junk food cookbook?
The fat-free junk food. I feel like I could use that now.
that was a result of going on a diet. I went on a low-fat diet and didn't have brownies. And I thought, you know, it's like just the fat's gone. There's no restriction on sugar. I should be able to make some brownies or some cookies or something. So it kind of came out of that. And eventually I came up with a cinnamon roll recipe that would make cinnamon rolls as big as your head that were fat free. And that was just great. And the decision was, do I write a cookbook or do I open a cinnamon roll shop? And at the time it was just kind of, you know, I think the cookbook's probably a better bet to go with. It's less risk. And so I sold about 15,000 copies of the cookbook. There were probably a third of them were printed in my basement.
Nice. So, really?
Yeah, I got it. Went and bought a Mike Martin of the Bengals worked for a office.
Mike Martin.
Yeah, he worked for an office copier company. And he said, and I said, hey, do you have something? Here's what I'm planning on doing. He's going, you're going to need something big. He says, but I know we've got a used machine that's been sitting there for a while. And so for like $1,500, I got this Fiat sized copier machine and put in my basement.
Wow.
And did all the printing myself and did all the binding and everything. It was really good until an article ran in the Enquirer, and then all of a sudden I have 1,000 orders and no books. And you start to think, I can't meet this. So I went and got a printer to print 10,000 copies and sold all those.
So, nice. Well,
yeah. How did you develop the did that take years to figure that out?
It took over a year to do the recipes on it. At the time, there was that was like really like the very start of the low fat movement, and it was great for me because the fact that when the book came out, there was nothing like that, and people were really interested. But it took about a year and a half to come up with all the recipes, just figuring out. You didn't have fat-free ingredients then, you know, so you really had to kind of figure out things on your own.
And were you into cooking already? Yeah. Like, that was just something...
Yeah, it was my dad's big thing was cooking, and he couldn't... He'd get a recipe and go, this looks great, and he couldn't even make it the normal way the first time he had to doctor it immediately before he even served it to you. It's like, we don't know what any of this food really tastes like because you don't go back and try the original one first. But yeah, so I just played around the kitchen and came up with recipes. I think there's something like 27 brownie recipes that were in here that were attempted, and one of them became the brownie recipe and two became cake recipes in the book.
Wow. So. Well, I'm disappointed you didn't bring anything.
I should have. Should have brought it.
If you're up since 4 a.m, you got time to do some baking?
Do you look back on that and feel like you just missed the window of digital books and also the movement for the type of recipes you're creating?
Not really. I mean, when at the time it was like before digital books, and so like literally at the dawn of digital contracts where publishers didn't know why lawyers were telling them to sign for digital rights, and so it was like I had a really good year.
Yeah.
That went first year, and after a year of selling it, I sold it to Random House for, and it's still available today. You can still buy it on Amazon.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
And I was able to I got like a $10,000 advance, and between the time I signed the contract and the time the book came out was 18 months. And I told the editor, I said, this fad's going to be gone in 18 months because the Atkins diet's coming in and this is going to disappear. And she was like, nothing I can do. That's when it's slated to go out. And so the book literally was remaindered before it was printed, that it was like, it went through this process where the publishing company changed their imprint and like changed their name. Everybody got fired and they essentially did reprints of other books. And the editor, the new editor before it came out, was talking to me and he says, well, we don't do cookbooks. And I said, well, you're doing mine.
This contract says you are.
Yeah. You're doing mine. I know you're printing 8,500 copies of this book. So it like had, they had a standing order of like 1,500 copies for a book club that bought it, and the rest were remaindered and, gone. And then 10 years later, I get an email from Random House and guy says, hey, I'm your new editor. We're gonna republish your cookbook. And it's like, what? And I said, it's like, it's gone. This movement is over. And he said, well, we have the technology now that we can do on-demand printing and we can print two books at a time in an order. And it was like, well, okay. So I've never gotten the rights back to it because it's technically going to be in print forever. And it was one of those things where it's like, yeah, I was done with the movement and, had passed the time where I was actually going to make any amount of money on it.
But what number are you working on now?
I'm working on a cookbook tentatively titled The Waffle Iron Chef.
Oh,
and it's...
Is this the
exclusive?
You are.
Wow. This is it. You are getting right. A jump on the world with this. recipes are mostly done. Really working on photography for it right now. And it's everything you can fix in your waffle iron, including everything you think you can't fix in your waffle iron, like hamburgers.
So that's basically what a George Foreman grill is, right?
It is. And hamburgers, the one thing about a waffle iron that's kind of fascinating, because this is like a really old, waffle irons are actually a really old concept, is that they cook like 200% more surface area than cooking something in a skillet because of the indents and everything. And you put a burger in a waffle iron and it gets unbelievably well cooked. So that like you don't have to deal with rare burgers anymore and burning the outside. You just pop into the waffle iron, close the lid, and you got yourself a perfectly cooked burger. So burgers, egg foo young, and there's even a waffle recipe in
there. I was just saying about waffles.
Yeah.
So I've got waffles like what I consider the perfect waffle recipe. And waffles, keto waffles, paleo waffles, vegan waffles, kind of gone through the gamut of all the dietary restrictions that people have today and created a waffle out of that.
Wow.
But it's number four. This is the fourth
cookbook. This is the fourth cookbook, yeah.
So what were two and three?
The Fat-Free Real Food Cookbook came out, and that was, again, one I sold on my own. And then my son and I, when he was like three, did a cookbook called the Hey Mom, I Like This Cookbook. And that was really kind of centered around telling stories and making food magical. Like one of my big things of the cookbook was we got to make spinach. We got to make kids try spinach. So it was one of those that's like never going to happen. So, you know, I crafted stories around it and we worked on it. And my son, when he was like 4 years old, was doing cooking demonstrations for this. It was just hilarious to watch him get up. And we, like, literally we'd go into a place, I'm trying to think of the Cookswares was one of the places. They had a really nice cooking school out in Montgomery. And it's like, we walk in and set up a ladder and all of a sudden this little head pops up and Tristan gets up and stands up on top of the ladder and starts showing people how to cook. So
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was fun. It was a lot of fun. And that one was printed. I printed that too. But now with digital printing, you can do it all. You know, you can pop something up on iTunes with no problem.
When's the waffle book? Do we have a?
I don't have a target yet. Don't have a target yet. It's photography is taking painstakingly longer than I had hoped, and so when that's done, then the book will be out. So,
is there an audio version of the cookbook?
No,
that's all the rage, right?
Oh my gosh! Let's get Gary to do a little Earl Pitts reading recipes.
Yeah, it's a mar.
Yeah, I don't know about audio for cookbooks. You know, it's just one of those things where I
yeah, that'd be a little boring.
But you know, people do watch TV. I mean, one of the things that I noticed right away with the cookbook was the number of people who bought the cookbook and didn't cook. And you'd talk to them and they were going, "No, I heard your book was a good read." It was like, what? And one of the women that I talked to at some kind of a charity event said that she doesn't do any cooking. As a matter of fact, she pulled the door off of her oven, and she uses her oven as a book rack to put all of her cookbooks in.
Really? No one comes by and turns that oven
right.
on,
right?
Well, it was just funny to hear that number of armchair chefs that are out there, and that people actually were just interested in reading cookbooks, and that was fun because the cookbook was actually written. It wasn't just a bunch of recipes, you know. It had stories around it, and it told various elements of you know, fat, low fat cooking, and why it's an advantage, and why it's a, you know, what you can do, little tips of what you can do to kind of change your recipes to remove fat from them.
Nice.
So you took a break from radio when this was
I took about a year off when that happened. Gary was always very insecure and was telling me that his contract was up in a year and a half, and that he knew that absolutely they weren't going to hire him back, and blah 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 blah. And I just thought, well, it sounds like a good opportunity for me to go out and do a project on my own. So I started working on the cookbook, and then we got to the point where it was out, and he was like, "Hey, they just renewed my contract." And I'm like, "Hey, I'm probably not going to stick around because I'm making a whole lot of money selling cookbooks."
Yeah, I remember every year was always the last year.
Like, yeah, right.
Yeah, when
right.
I first got there, I was like, "Well, there's probably a year left on this, but right. okay."
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, he would say that the contract. I remember there was one time he said, "You know, I've only got like a year left on my contract," and he comes back after talking to Randy Michaels and he goes, "Actually, I've got four left on my contract. I didn't realize I signed a 5-year contract."
So, how did you take over the Senseless Survey?
That was just mine. Gary wanted something different, and he said, "Maybe you could do, like, could you call people and do surveys?"
Now, is this pre-Gilbert or post-Gilbert?
It's post-Gilbert. Gilbert already existed.
All right.
And so I'm like, "Yeah, we'll give it a try." So I came up with the character and some questions, and then I got help from Duke, and pretty much all the Burbank writers chipped in and wrote some questions for it, and would just ask things that were off the wall, and it was so much fun to talk to people, because there was like almost always in the middle of a phone call there was a point where you they'd pause and you'd know that they're thinking, "This is the most ridiculous thing I've ever been asked in my life. but I'm going to answer it in case this guy's legitimate.
Yeah. And I recall it took you making a lot of phone calls, didn't it?
Yeah. It was like 40 to 50 calls to get two usable ones. Wow. But that was everything from dialing and not getting an answer to people hanging up on you and whatever. Usually once you get them on the line, you can make it fly. You just start asking them some weird questions. And, you know, it's kind of that thing that if you ask in a convincing way, people feel they're obliged to answer.
Yeah.
So, and we also called, like, we were real fortunate that Duke had come back from South Carolina and brought a Columbia, South Carolina phone book, which literally is like a half inch thick. And I started just calling number after number. And it was great because there were people from New York that had retired there, people who lived there. Paris Island military base was near there. Oh, so you got 18-year-old, 19-year-old guys that you just can't get on surveys. And you'd like call them up and it's like they just got off their shift and they'd talk to you. You know, they would be having a beer sitting there chatting with you. And Dufusky Island is there, which the accent sounds almost Caribbean. And so just a wonderful cross-section of people to talk to down there. And they were very polite, and they answered the phone. And I remember it called Providence, Rhode Island once. And I would go to the library and just copy pages out of the phone book. And I made like 60 calls, and I didn't get a single person that stayed on the line at all. And that didn't curse me out. It was like, man, I don't know that I ever want to go to Providence or anything.
Have we talked about Letters from a Nut on this podcast?
Yes. Who do we talk to about that? I don't remember.
That's what it reminds me of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you read that book?
I've heard of the book, but I haven't read it.
It's just a guy that under a fake name would write outrageous letters to different companies, and then he would print the reply that he got. But it was the same kind of thing of like, you can, like, it's so absurd, but you can tell that there's genuinely somebody that goes, man, just in case this is real, I have to actually answer it.
Well, Gilbert Gnarly, who was, you know, the census survey is something that people can get grasp on and understand what it's for. Gilbert Gnarly, on the other hand, was a character that in all honesty, people don't realize that it's like if you tried to do, Gary tried to do Earl Pitts doing that same thing, he would have gotten nowhere with it. But Gilbert was this helpless old guy. Everybody just wanted to help him, you know? And he'd called, it was back when American Express was advertising for, if you lose your traveler's checks, you get them back free. And he called up and he's real excited and he's saying, yeah, I just lost all my traveler's checks playing Keno. He's going, blackjack is next. Can I get my, and the woman was like, look, sir, you know, that's not how this works. And he goes, you mean I don't get them back? And he goes, but it's like spent all my money. And, he's going, well, I'm sure the casino would understand if I told him I'll pay him back later. She's going, yeah, right. But with a few of those people, I actually called him back. Said, hey, I'm his grandson, and I just want to let you know everything worked out okay. And
that's really funny that you did that.
Well, it's there. One of Gary's beliefs about radio is you shouldn't do something that actually leaves people in grief. Unless they really deserve it, you know. Yeah. A city councilman and you call them a name, well, they deserve it, you know. But if you go back and you're talking to somebody on the phone that you completely don't know and they're, you know, it's a good idea if you feel they're in distress, call them back and just say, hey, that everything's okay. He never admit that it was a prank, you know. Yeah. We would just call him back and pretend like it was all right.
I'll never forget the first time I heard it. My high school baseball coach ran the batting cages at the Red Bank Cincinnati Sports Mall.
Yeah, right.
And he would just have 700 on.
Yeah.
Like, I'd never heard of Gilbert Gnarly before, and he's like, oh, Gilbert Gnarly's about to come on. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, just listen to it. And he was called KY Jelly.
Yes.
And said, I think I got a bad batch because I put
it's got no flavor to it.
It just tastes
off. Flavorless.
And I was like, what is this I'm listening to? I was like a sophomore in high school.
Yeah.
And it was just like, Yeah. It blew my mind. Like, yeah. It was like the funniest thing I'd ever heard on the radio before.
He was, but you know, it's interesting because Gilbert was what I would always consider Gary's most popular character. But Earl Pitts by far had the popular vote, you know.
Yeah.
And it's still today, Earl Pitts is syndicated in 50 or 60 markets, 70
That's
markets.
Insane.
Yeah.
Who chose the music for Gilbert? That little book.
That was probably literally just thrown on.
It's weird because I remember listening to the show
even
before I worked there. It was you would hear that music start up.
Yeah.
You'd hear the dial tone, and utter you start laughing because you knew something really hilarious was coming.
Right.
Yeah.
LW had a library of stuff that was just great because they had years and years of stuff on record. And, you know, we would find bizarre singles out at the transmitter. They used to keep, like, literally all the records were all stuck out at the transmitter. So we'd go out and we'd kind of browse around and look, and we found Nick Clooney singing in a little red barn on a farm in Indiana. And just off the wall stuff, Margaret and her singing saw. And somewhere along the way, we just find some of these themes that were really obscure, that nobody knew that existed in that record. Maybe they printed 100 copies of it and we happened to have it, and then we'd use it.
People can follow you. Like, I'm looking at it. I mean, you do, like, reviews on technology.
Yeah.
Like, you're looks like you're a big Apple guy.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I
photography, too.
Because Apple's are fat-free.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
No, I love technology. Photography's always been a big hobby of mine. I'm actually real fortunate to have had some friends that were really, really great photographers, and that was a huge plus. And then when film went out, I jumped into digital right away, you know, and that was a lot of fun, and it was just a totally different market. But a lot of those people who used to do film photography just at that point dropped it. They don't do it anymore. And I just saw opportunities now. There's so much going on today with computational photography, taking a crappy image off of a crappy sensor on your telephone and turning it into something, you know, beautiful, that there's just, we have the ability to do that today. And so I'm just fascinated by this. I love playing around with, you know, taking out the iPhone and shooting stuff. So that's fun. Music's another thing. I just love pedals. And so I have, like, you know, hundreds of pedals that I've bought, and I play the ukulele. So it's like,
nice. You are like a renaissance man.
Ukuleles?
Well, you plug an acoustic ukulele into a guitar pedal, and you realize it only works with about 10% of them. So it's like, I've got an awful lot of pedals sitting around that are completely useless to me. But yeah, it's fun. I just, you know, I'm just an obsessed person, and that is one of those things where it's like,
awesome.
I've been very fortunate that my addictions haven't come out in some other way, and that it's like literally just screwing around with stuff and learning new things all the time. I love that. I love finding out something about it. Of course, I'm old enough now I can't remember it the next day, but, you know, at least I discovered it.
But people can, like, check out your Facebook page or where else can they find you?
The blog's probably the best place to go.
Okay.
wolfwithane.com. And that's WOOLFE with an E.com.
Yeah.
And that's got most everything on it that you want to find.
We'll put a link to it on the blog post for this episode.
Excellent. Yep. Thank you.
We always ask our guests to give us a coupon code that people can use to save some money until the next episode comes out.
Oh, man, a coupon code. Okay.
On our shirts at SensiShirts.com and in our stores.
Yeah.
Not on cookbooks.
Yeah.
It's not going to save them. Well, good. That's up to you.
Yeah. So what do I need to do for the coupon code?
You just tell us what you want it to be.
Oh, man, I got to pick?
Yep.
God, I didn't know there was going to be
the pressure.
These kind of questions.
some good codes.
Let's just do Doc Wolf.
All right.
There you go.
WOLFE, just so you know.
Yep. All right.
Cool. So you don't put, if you just
put. DOCWOLFE.
Yeah.
Yep.
You'll do it as without a space.
Just do it all one word.
Yeah, right. all one word.
That's what most people do coupon codes. Yeah. Okay.
So type in Doc Wolf. You'll save 20% on your order online. Mm-hmm. And you can also mention it at any of our three stores, Over the Rhine, Hyde Park, and Loveland. And that'll be good until the next episode comes out. Thanks for being here, man.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. Fun. Yeah, it is. It's fun. It's fun to talk about some of these things that pop up that you almost kind of forget that happened because so much went on, especially during the Burbank days.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful to kind of revive that and get it out.
Well, it's such an iconic show and like beloved by so many people. Not just here, including Tampa, Florida, where it will forever live on cassette tape.
Right. And Louisville, Kentucky, where Gary is still, I mean, he's probably going to get sainthood out of Louisville.
Good for him. He deserves it. You do too. Doc.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Doc Wolf. Well, as I said in the interview there when we were talking with Doc, and I'd written on the show for 11 years, and when I first got the gig, Rob Irvin, who pulled me into the show, who was the producer at the time, said this probably only lasts about a year because Gary's going to retire. And, well, 11 years later, he finally did. And fun to hear. I didn't really know a lot of those stories, or I've only heard bits and pieces of them. So, and we are going to try and get Gary on the show. He said he will do the show. We just need to put together a time and a place where we can get that sorted. But that's probably going to involve Josh, I, and perhaps Darren going on a little road trip over to Northern Kentucky. So if there's someone you'd like to hear on the podcast, just drop us an email, podcast@cincyshirts.com. Put podcast guest in the subject line, then tell us who you'd like to hear on the show, maybe a little background on them, why you think they'd be a good guest. Be sure to tell friends and loved ones about the show, including folks who may no longer live in the area but still feel connected to the tri-state. And if you haven't already, go back and plunder the Cincy Shirts podcast archives, 93 episodes back there, 94 now with this one. So lots of great people on there. The famous, the not famous, all the folks that make Cincinnati and the tri-state State such a great place. Today's show is produced by me with help from Josh and Darren. Our theme music is Cincinnati by Big Nothing. They are from Philadelphia. You can find their music in iTunes, Spotify, or wherever else you get your music. Find vintage tees from great places like Philadelphia, Boston, Phoenix, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Louisville, Seattle, and so many more at oldschoolshirts.com. Lots of defunct sports teams, old restaurants, old radio stations, as a matter of fact. It's like Cincy Shirts, but for those towns. So if you're shopping this Christmas for someone and they don't live in Cincinnati and never have, maybe they live in Detroit or Louisville or Indianapolis. So we have a lot of old stuff there that they might enjoy getting from you as well. And again, the promo code for this episode is Doc Wolf. It's all one word. Wolf has an E on the end there. And it's all lowercase, all uppercase. Either way works. There's no dash. There's no underscore. There's nothing like that. It's all one word. So use that to take 20% off your entire CincyShirts.com or OldSchoolShirts.com. You can actually use it once on each site. How about that? You can also use the code in our physical or brick-and-mortar Cincy Shirt stores in Over the Rhine, Hyde Park, and Loveland. Follow our social channels, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat for the latest Cincy Shirts news. Give us a good review wherever you get the podcast from. And as always, download or stream us next time. Bye.